Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. I'm glad you're here. Here at moralapologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument for God's existence, because this argument has the power to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. I'm your host, Jonathan Brewitt. I hope you had a very Merry Christmas, and if you haven't had the chance, I encourage you to go back and listen to our special Christmas edition of the podcast with Dr. Emily Hetty on A Christmas Carol, Ethics, and the Christian Worldview. On this week's episode, we will again be speaking with Dr. Hetty. Dr. Hetty was born and raised in Southern Ohio. She holds a BA in Spanish and English from The Ohio State University, and an MA and PhD in English Literature with a concentration in Victorian Studies from Indiana University. In addition to holding a faculty position in the English department, Dr. Hetty has previously directed Liberty's writing program. She is now the Dean of the College of General Studies, which oversees general education for all Liberty students. My aim with this conversation was to learn from Dr. Hetty about the connection between literature, ethics, and the Christian worldview, and Dr. Hetty really helped me to see how these issues are related. After just about everything she said, I had light bulbs going off in my head. It was a really great learning experience and a good time, and I expect to have the same opinion by the end of our conversation. With that, we'll head over to Dr. Hetty's office and hear what she has to say about literature, ethics, and the Christian worldview. All right, well, Dr. Hetty, could you just start off with telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so we begin with the job interview question, right?
Yeah.
I'm a northerner, so you'll have to forgive me if I talk fast at any point here. I'm from Ohio. I'm born and raised in a small town, and I'm still small town, I think, in all sorts of ways. Might be part of my attraction to Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
He's always kind of moving back and forth between cities and small towns. I'm trying to make the city into a small town. So Lynchburg's great. Love Lynchburg.
Yeah.
Went to school at Ohio State, then at Indiana for my doctorate. Was very privileged to study under some great, great Victorianists whose ways of thinking still elude me, though I'm trying to chase them. So that's good. Been at Liberty for 9 years. Served in a variety of capacities here as an English professor, director of the writing program, and now as a dean in the College of General Studies, and we oversee general education.
Okay. Well, very cool. I had kind of a thesis that I sent to you.
Yes.
That I want you to see if I'm totally off base here. But I said that, well, what if we could think of literature, all literature, as a kind of revelation mm-hmm. from God? Because, of course, not special revelation, that needs to be, it's not like scripture, but in the same way that nature reveals God, maybe mm-hmm. all literature does. Because all authors are made in the image of God,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, maybe if you look closely enough at their works, even atheists,
mm-hmm.
you'd be able to detect at some level that this was actually true about them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can just start off with you tell me if that's crazy or what you think of that thesis there.
Yeah, I don't think it's crazy at all. I would want to distinguish between good literature
mm-hmm.
and poorly executed literature.
Okay.
I know there's some debate about what that might mean, but I would say that the novel I wrote when I was 12 years old would not rise to the level of something that reveals anything about much of anything except uh-huh. my sad 12-year-old self. And I think there's some stuff that gets published that many people would claim has a sort of authority that it hasn't earned.
Okay.
So let's talk about good literature, though.
Okay.
And by that I mean literature where the characters behave more or less like people behave. They're complicated.
They're true to life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily mean they're ordinary,
mm-hmm.
But that they could exist, that they're probable, they're believable. That the plots that are happening in there are believable according to the terms that the author has set. Right? So, you know, a science fiction universe can behave by science fiction's rules, and that's fine. So all that being said, I don't have any problem with saying that even an atheist, even an author whose worldview is still in development, it's still inconsistent, it's maybe waffling between agnosticism and Christianity, or maybe the author thinks that they're a Christian, but their worldview seems to have various components in it that really don't fit well with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of that can reveal truth. It may reveal truth, God's truth, by its very contradictoriness. We might be able to look at a character who's behaving in a believable fashion, but who has a flawed way of doing things, and learn something about this universe that we live in just by watching that behavior. So I actually think your thesis is fine.
Okay, cool, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder, could you give us an example of like a maybe an atheist writer that where some of the themes or ideas that come out that might reveal this image of God in the person?
Okay, I'm going to go with an agnostic.
Okay, all right, sure.
I'm going to go with George Eliot.
Okay.
Actually, George Eliot started out as an evangelical, and then sort of slowly, her faith dribbled away, and it became a kind of cultural faith, but that was really it. By the end of her life, she was saying, basically, you know, I believe in duty. I understand duty, my duty to my fellow man. I get that. You know, I get people, but I can't really believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't saying there is no God, so she wouldn't quite go there, just that she couldn't believe in him. And George Eliot gives us a remarkably consistent, not Christian universe, where people are operating by largely Darwinian rules. Character is operating by Darwinian rules, and the strongest, the economically strongest, the smartest, the healthiest,
mm-hmm.
Find ways of rising up the hierarchy. So we get to watch that universe playing out, and I think it's some of the most beautiful literature I've ever seen, but it's also some of the saddest because of that. Now, she runs into moments that are problems for her. For example, in Middlemarch, I think her best novel, there's one coincidence in the book. A couple of characters run into each other in Rome. These are English characters from the countryside who just happen to run into each other in Rome.
Interesting.
And then this inaugurates a marriage plot, which ends up being kind of the ending of the book. You can't really explain that by Darwinian rules.
Yeah,
It wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of tiny fault line that I think we can look at. That being said, her achievement's astounding. We learn a lot about how people function from reading that.
Okay, very cool. Well, so I want to ask you some general questions here too. So the first one I have is, what can Christians learn by reading literature? And I think you already kind of hit on that, but maybe you want to add any more to that?
Maybe a little bit. I have a colleague over in the English department, Matt Tolles, who's a favorite colleague in part because he's very, very funny all the time. Who talks about fiction as something that lets us try on other selves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot to that. You know, rather than having to go off and, you know, party yourself into oblivion at college, why don't you just read about a character who does that?
Yeah.
And sort of vicariously live that for a few moments and then maybe realize that's not necessarily a great way to live. It's not a good plan. I think literature can do that. Literature can teach us sympathy with types that we maybe in real life wouldn't necessarily want to talk to.
So literature can kind of give us moral exemplars, both good and bad,
yes,
that we can see, you know, this is what happens if you live this kind of mm-hmm. moral life, or and here's the consequences. And I think Scrooge is going to be a good example of that.
He is,
later.
Yeah.
Okay. This is another question I have. Are there ideas that are best communicated in literature instead of philosophy or theology? And I mentioned, you know, C.S. Lewis is a person who wrote in both camps.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a lot of nonfiction, but he also wrote, and one of his most famous theological works, The Great Divorce,
mm-hmm.
is written as literature, as fiction.
Yep.
So I wonder, do you think there are certain ideas that literature can communicate better than philosophy and theology?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd say there are certain ideas that are better communicated through literature, but I think it's a different and a more flexible and maybe a more dynamic way of communicating.
Okay.
For example, to take parables,
mm-hmm.
Which are not exactly fictional, but anyway, they're stories,
right?
Frank Kermode's got a great book on parables, and he lays out just kind of the Greek origin of the term, right, to come alongside, right? So if you understand the parable of the wheat and the tares, for instance, you can read that literally, and it's kind of a boring story.
Right.
All you do is read it literally.
Mm-hmm.
You can apply it to the Christian life, and then you can understand some things about, you know, why good and bad coexist,
what's going to happen in the end times. And that's good, too. But the power of the parable comes from the back and forth, right? From the movement between all the different ways you can read the story and then the ways that you can apply it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's where the power is, because different groups of readers will apply it a bit differently, depending on where they're coming from, their stage in their life, and so on. I know, for example, the parable of the four soils when I was a kid. You know, I would just kind of go through it systematically, mm-hmm. you know, in church or wherever. And so, you know, I really hope I'm not rocky soil.
Yeah.
I really hope that. I really hope I'm not shallow. And that was really as far as I went with it. As I got older, I started understanding gardening a little bit better. And then I thought, you know, there's certain types of seeds that grow better in certain types of soils. So it grows more complicated. I trust that as my life goes on, I'll understand a little bit more about it. And I think that's what story can do. It can get inside us in different ways at different times.
I was just listening to a lecture by Yancey Wright last night, actually, where he talked about that parable, and he mentioned that Jesus constantly used this phrase, if you have ears to hear, which indicates that the stories that he told, the parables he told, were meant to be kind of chewed over and thought through.
Yep.
And that's an interesting point in general, too. Why did Jesus not just do what Paul did in Romans and just write out all the propositions of what he was trying to say? But, you know, most of the teaching of Jesus is not straightforward. It's in a literary format. And I think maybe, I think what you're saying is that it engages you as a person more and it makes it more personal. So I think that's very good.
It's maybe a little divisive, too, sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I know there are parables I just didn't get until certain points in my life. And it wasn't that I, you know, had no faith or desire to get them. I just didn't get them. So they create an in-group and an out-group, in a sense.
Yeah, well, and I think that's kind of maybe what Jesus was getting at, is if you have ears to hear, you know, take this, what I'm saying, and really try to deal with it. And I'm also reminded, too, of when he told people in a metaphor that to eat his flesh and to drink his blood, which is a literary device, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that he did that because he knew people were just following him for the wrong reasons, and he wanted to invite people to really consider what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think that's a great answer. So here's another question. How can we learn truth from stories? Which we just hit on this, funny enough, but why is the Bible written as story and poetry, and why are humans so interested in stories?
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's kind of a huge question, right? I don't know. I teach on a couple of different levels. And, you know, I'm overseeing Gen Ed, which means I spend a lot of time reading about and thinking about what do you do with 18-year-olds who are just showing up at college and who are, you know, maybe out of mom and dad's house for the first time. And it really kind of seems, and maybe this is my bias as an English professor, but it seems like what's happening is that they're trying to figure out how to write their own life story. So we need to read in part to know how to write ourselves. So, I mean, there's that piece of it. And, you know, we get a lot of students who just, they don't know how. They don't even know that they need to write themselves. But everybody's writing all the time.
I was reading a little bit of Alvin Plantinga's, who's a Christian philosopher, his biography, and he made a comment that was very similar to that. He said that writing an autobiography is one of the most dangerous things you can do because you're prone to tell a story that isn't true. You know, you're prone to draw things together. You're prone to be a bad interpreter of your own life.
Yeah.
And if you're good literary thinker, then maybe you're better at understanding the narrative of your own life. That's certainly a value we get from stories.
Yeah, I think so, anyway. And I think that engaging with different genres, you know, the history genre, the prophecy, poetry, you know, all of these things, it's important to do that because those are all, they're all ways of telling truth that have rules by which they operate, and the rules say something about the author at the same time, right? If I have, you know, deep thoughts about love, for instance, I'm probably not going to write history.
Right.
I'm probably going to write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something in arranging words, right, and in that act of authorship that can call out to that emotive experience in a way that writing a history can't. Though if I'm going to go into a job interview and someone says, tell me about yourself, I mean, I'm writing history at that moment. I'm not going to, you know, give you a haiku.
Yeah, well, if you want the job, I guess
that's
you're...
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So then, why do you think the Bible is written mostly a story? Do you have thought on that?
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back a little bit to what I was saying before, which is that it's a more open invitation for us to enter the story at whatever point we can enter it. I mean, I think grace works like that, right? You know, it kind of comes and finds us where we are.
Yeah.
It issues an invitation, which we can, you know, choose to accept and write that into our story, or we can choose to reject and say, you know, sorry, the story is not for me.
Yeah, it portrays that God is involved with people and that there is an end of history and that you're invited to participate in this.
Yeah.
So it, I mean, it's a story partially because that's what God's telling us. You know, he's got a narrative that he's trying to communicate to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the, you know, we talk a lot about the kind of, you know, sin and redemption cycle here at Liberty. And I mean, yeah, that's Christian worldview and that's important. I think the thing that's important in that, though, is it's kind of sin and redemption to an end. There's a teleology in it.
Yeah.
And we don't have any meaning to anything if we don't have telos, right? There's no end to it.
Right.
There's no direction we're going. And that's what happens with George Eliot. She doesn't have that, right? The Darwinian narrative doesn't go anywhere in particular. Maybe it is, and maybe it's an accurate way of describing certain things that are happening around us in culture. We see that all the time, but we lose ultimate meaning. We lose ultimate purpose.
Yeah, so going back to what you said about the Bible then, I think is what you're saying is because the story communicates to us the direction that telos and invites us to take on that as our direction and our telos.
Right.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so here's one about literature in general. And do novels often assume a Christian worldview, even if they're atheists? And what counts as a Christian worldview in a novel? What do you, if you're going to say as a literary scholar, well, this book, you know, this novel or poem or whatever it is has Christian worldview. What are the kind of the criteria you might look for?
Yeah, that's of course I'm, you know, I am the only authority on this question,
Yeah,
we're just talking, right?
Yeah.
I got a good paper from a student yesterday that I read, and I actually had to push back with him at him on this question of Christian worldview, because he said, you know, we have this author, you know, Anne Radcliffe, who's punishing the evil characters and rewarding the good characters, and this is commensurate with her Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, stop, right? Because the good characters were good from the beginning, right? They're originally good, and the evil characters are irredeemably evil. That doesn't sound Christian to me.
Right, no, it doesn't.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But then to your second question, is she assuming that she has a Christian worldview, and is she assuming that that's commensurate with her audience's Christian worldview?
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Okay.
In some kind of floppy Anglican way.
Okay.
When you sent me your thoughts about what we talked about ahead of time, I said I was going to push back at you on some of the questions, and this is the one in particular I wanted to push back on.
Okay, yeah.
Because if you start going down the road in literary studies, questions about who the author is, who the readers are, start getting really, really complicated. Okay, because sometimes the author of the text, the guy who wrote it or the woman who wrote it, isn't necessarily the implied author.
Okay, interesting.
Right. So somebody like Dickens had some real faith questions. I mean, some pretty deep ones. And they changed over the course of his life, and his position vis-a-vis those questions changed. So, who Dickens was at the moment isn't necessarily reflected in his public persona that's publishing those books. So there's that. There's also the audience and the implied audience, right? The actual real people who have all kinds of mess in their life who are reading the books versus the more or less together audience that the author is writing for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a little bit of a sleight of hand going on. Kind of like, well, we're all Christians, we're all Orthodox, wink, wink.
Right. Yeah.
We might have other deep questions. We're going to set those aside because this transaction between author and reader needs to be neater than that.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that help at all?
Yeah, that does help. Because, I mean, I guess I'm thinking, like, if you were writing, like, I'm just thinking biblically here for a second. All those questions are central to, I mean, they're the same questions, but I think they just get more complicated in literature because of what's going on. But, you know, who's the author? What's his context? What's his intentions?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the audience? You know, and you're thinking of like if you're thinking about letters of Paul, you're thinking of particular,
it's complicated, yeah.
You know, but when you go into the literary context, you're saying, well, okay, all those questions are important, but what's also important is like, who is this author constructing himself to be in writing this novel, and who's his imagined audience? So it gets much more sophisticated.
Yeah, it does. And then there's the narrator, right, who may not be the author.
Right. Yeah. So, oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, these are deeply biblical questions, though, and I don't necessarily have answers to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was, you know, at an earlier point in my life, you know, I'd read a passage in Paul about, you know, women should have long hair.
Uh-huh.
I would ask, well, why don't we follow this? Oh, well, that was, he was writing for an audience a long time ago, and that's not our custom now.
Right.
But why can we kick out a rule like that, but we can't kick out other rules?
Yeah.
You know, when do we proof text a certain way, and when do we not? I'm not sure I've even got the skills now to fully think that through.
Yeah.
But I don't think we can just easily kick things out by saying, well, that was intended for someone else.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. This is where your skills as a literary scholar can come in and help disambiguate those, I think, too. But just, it's hard. It's, literature is complicated.
It's very complicated.
Okay.
It's wonderful.
It is, yeah. Here's one. It's kind of like the last one, but it's a little more general. It says, do novels and other works of literature often assume a moral universe where some acts are wrong and others are right and where justice is ultimately done? Do they attempt to explain this universe, or is it just assumed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer to it would shift depending on what time period you're talking uh-huh. about. Somebody like, I mentioned Anne Radcliffe earlier, assumes a very just universe, you know, where the good are rewarded and the bad are punished. In part because of, I think, a sort of general belief that things will come right in the end, that the broad Judeo-Christian ethic is right. But it gets a lot more complicated than that. I mean, it's not just that the good are rewarded, it's that the good are made richer. You know, they marry well, or property is moved back to the people who deserve to have it,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't see as biblical necessarily at all. So there's that.
Right.
But there is an easy assumption of that. Okay, then, you know, by the 1890s, you've got Oscar Wilde comically, but I think insightfully writing in The Importance of Being Earnest, about the horrible novel that Miss Prism wrote. The good end happily and the bad end unhappily, that is what fiction means.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an awareness by the time you get to the end of the 19th century that these are fictional conventions, right? These are genre conventions.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that it always happens that way in the world.
Right.
On the other hand, there's something reassuring about it happening that way in literature.
And then I guess maybe once they become aware of these conventions, they start to break them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they start messing with them.
And then the moral universe is not necessarily assumed at all.
That's right.
But in a sense, you might say it's assumed because they're consciously breaking it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that anybody can ever completely kick out a moral universe.
Yeah.
When they're writing anything, even the kind of darkest and most horrific thing has a moral universe of some sort, because it wouldn't seem dark and horrific if there weren't morality
yeah.
informing it somehow.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think this is kind of what I was... Let's go back to that image mm-hmm. of God question. So if you think of a dark novel, and it seems totally pointless, hopeless, you know, etc. I wonder what. So, how do you read out the image of God in that kind of literature?
Yeah, I think it's a negative example.
Okay,
I think, and I don't have a whole lot of joy in reading novels like that.
Yeah.
You know, there are, you know, Christian scholars who teach at this university who really enjoy engaging with that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not me. When I read Apocalypse Now for the first time, you know, I'd read Heart of Darkness before that, I was just really bothered. I don't want to live in that world.
Uh-huh.
I think in part because that represents a kind of person I don't want to be around, which is a challenge to me as somebody who's supposed to be learning compassion
mm-hmm.
and sympathy, and, you know, I'm supposed to be able to go into dark places, and I sometimes resist it. Because I'd rather spend my time in a more easily moral universe.
But it seems like maybe this is what, so even in the title,
mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now, mm-hmm. which is which I didn't even think about that at first, but that's a biblical title
it
anyway.
Is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the title suggests that that the book is bad, you know.
Yeah.
So it's even in that level, it's like, okay, well, I'm aware that this is actually not desirable, not good, and
right.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't think of a book that's amoral. I mean, I can think of books that don't ground morality in some idea of God,
right.
or some mm-hmm. sort of abstract idea,
mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, Nietzschean might makes right morality. I can think of that. I can't think of one that doesn't have anything.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Which, yeah, that's interesting. Okay. What ways, okay, we already hit on these last two, but I think the first one is, what role does the Imago Dei have in writing literature? Well, yeah, we had actually asked that question. What does that have to do with in the actual composition of literature?
That's a great question. I mean, I tend to think, no, I know, I don't tend to think. I mean, God made us in his image, right?
Right.
And mm-hmm. part of that means that we're creative. No matter, I mean, I guess engineers might disagree with me on this, I'm not sure, some engineers might. I really have trouble believing that artificial intelligence is ever going to be able mm-hmm. to do a pure act of artistry or a pure act of creativity.
Yeah.
I think that's the absence of the Imago Dei, right?
There's also good, and just as a side note there, I agree with you as I hesitate to say I'm a philosopher or anything, but I studied philosophy of mind a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and there's all kinds of interesting arguments that no machine could ever have a soul, right?
Right.
They could only ever mimic
mm-hmm.
Or do what they're programmed to do, and having a soul requires this metaphysical entity that mm-hmm. machines just don't have.
Yeah.
But, anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, insofar as, you know, anyone, even the most corrupt imaginable person, is doing something creative,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the image of God.
Right.
I think we have to be really careful in how we understand what authors are doing, though. I mean, I worry about philosophy that would say that, you know, we're just a product of social conditioning,
mm-hmm.
for instance, because then we lose that, the ability to be creative. We think we can quench it a bit. People who've been severely abused for a long time perhaps lack that capacity to the same extent as somebody who's been developed well by his circumstances have it.
This thought stirred up in my head is, you know, Daniel Dennett
mm-hmm.
talks about humans as machines, right?
Mm-hmm.
As extremely sophisticated machines that just operate according to physical laws. And how could it, and I guess back to what we just said, but I'm just thinking about a slightly different angle. If literature really has the qualities that we think it has,
mm-hmm.
of being good or having beauty and communicating truth, how could a machine ever do that, even a fancy biological machine?
I don't think it can.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it can mimic that. I mean, if it's been communicated previously in some compelling form,
right.
it can do the same thing again.
But yeah, it seems like if you're a machine, if we're all machines, right, then the best what we're doing is fooling ourselves into thinking mm-hmm. that there's such a thing as good literature.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think humans can be taught to act like machines, though. And I think I mentioned I spend a lot of time reading, you know, about education.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I worry about. I think about it. I don't think it's something we want to kick out. But, for example, how do you teach math, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to learn math, except those people who are going to be math
majors. Yeah,
except
for the math weirdos, yeah.
Right, right. Now, we can get pretty good results by running students through a kind of computer program.
Mm-hmm.
Success rates go way up, you know, when you do this. And we've adopted it at Liberty, and it's good. I can't make the light bulb come on, though. I can't make a student suddenly say, I see why I need to know math.
Mm-hmm.
There's no computer program that can do that.
No.
Then the question becomes, you know, when you program that heavily, are you actually kind of stopping the light bulb moment from happening?
Yeah, and you're just teaching rote
right.
Programming.
Right. I mean, these are bigger questions than just Liberty can solve.
Right. Right?
You know, the Department of Education wants everybody to look the same way when they graduate.
So here's a question.
Mm-hmm.
Since our, you know, I don't necessarily like to make broad sweeping statements mm-hmm. about culture, but suppose that our culture is actually increasingly influenced to think that people are material mm-hmm. machines. Have you seen a corresponding decrease in the quality of literature that's coming out related to that?
That's a great question. That's a really great question. I think it's partly related to that if there is a decrease in quality. I think we're at a weird time with literary output now. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of young adult fiction really taking off as kind of the genre of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it concerns me a little bit to have, you know, my friend who's 65 years old or whatever going on and on about Twilight.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, there's something wrong with you. You know, first of all, it's not a very good book. And also, you're at the wrong stage in life to be reading this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's not okay for you to be doing this. Yet, that's the imaginative experience she wants. And she's not the only person. Now, yes, you can have serious scholarly engagement, serious imaginative engagement with Harry Potter, or with even with Twilight.
Right, right.
That being said, you know, even maybe 20 years ago, the books that people were talking about were not young adult. Okay. So is some sort of adolescence being programmed back into us? Are we being stunted somehow?
That's such an interesting thought, because I think about, I never even thought about this before. You just turned a light bulb on for me there.
Woohoo!
You know, that literature would correspond with, like, stages of human flourishing.
Right, right.
That you would, you know, maybe would be appropriate for a teenager to read Twilight and to become aware of these poorly executed mm-hmm. ideas in there, and then move on to something like, I don't know, like Lord of the Rings is a, for example, is a richer
mm-hmm.
world, but you also have to be a kind of a richer
That's right.
person to be able to get it. Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. Thank you for that realization there.
That being said, there are beacons of hope. There's Marilyn Robinson, for instance, and you know, people made fun of the Oprah Book Club, but she got a lot of people reading some really great literature, and I think for that she needs to be thanked
okay.
and praised. So some good can happen.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And then just as kind of wrap this section up,
mm-hmm.
The broad question, in what ways can we see God revealing himself in literature? And that hits on a lot of the stuff we already talked about, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think we mostly talked about the kind of interaction between the author and the reader, or between the reader and the text, right? What's
right.
happening to that person who's reading a book? So there's that. As a literary scholar, I'm actually more interested in patterns of reading mm-hmm. happening in culture now. So this question about young adult fiction, why is everybody suddenly reading young adult fiction?
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, that's God revealing himself through what people are reading. Okay, and it's not just God saying, you know, look at me, I'm in Twilight. It's not that.
Right,
I hope
right.
It's not that, right? It's more like, look at your culture. Here are the things that they're really interested in right now.
Yeah.
How are you going to address your message to that set?
That's, I love that thought. Yeah. Yeah, that what, you can look on the best sellers list and see what our culture values
right.
to a certain extent. And this reminds me, I was listening to J.P. Moreland,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Love your God with all your mind. And he made this point about Christian literature,
mm-hmm.
Christian nonfiction, too, that if you go and look at the top sellers in Christian literature, you're going to see mostly what he calls narcissistic, self-help,
That's
trivial
true.
Sort of stuff that
mm-hmm.
It's you know, just designed to kind of help you lose weight or, you know...
Yeah, follow this grain diet.
And, yeah, get a better job or something, yeah. And that you're not going to see a lot of, you know, rich theology works or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's not, I mean, yeah, it's sad. It makes me want to, you know, mourn and everything else.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's an invitation, especially to those of us who are in education or who are doing things like philosophy or whatever, to say, okay, we need to, first of all, teach people to read better. You know, make it to where they can handle at least something like Dallas Willard.
Yeah.
Who's doing it, who did great work.
Right, yeah, that was... J.P. Moreland's mentor, by the way.
Oh, great.
That's just an interesting
connection
there. And thanks again, Dr. Hetty, for those very insightful comments on the relationship between literature, ethics, and the Christian worldview. And thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you get a chance, head on over to moralapologetics.com. There you'll find new content going up almost every day from literary scholars like Dr. Hetty, from philosophers, theologians, and biblical scholars. And I think you'll see it's a really tremendous resource for anything related to the moral argument. Also, if you could give us a like on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, then you'll stay up to date with all the exciting things happening at moralapologetics.com. And we hope you have a great week and meet us back here again next week.